This recording is part of the University of Adelaide Archives Programme of Oral History, in which members of staff and former members of staff of the university are interviewed so that a record exists, in their own words, of their own achievements and activities at the university, and also to capture their recollections and opinions about the university more generally. This interview is with Dr. Alan Brissenden, formerly reader in the Department of English at the University of Adelaide. Alan was born in Griffith, New South Wales in 1932. He was educated in a one-teacher school, Neela Creek, then at Cowra High School, and at the University of Sydney, graduating with a BA and a Diploma of Education. After 5 years with the New South Wales Education Department, he studied for a PhD at the University of London, graduating in 1963. His PhD thesis, rather daring in those days, was Sexual Themes in Jacobean Drama. From London in the same year, Alan was appointed to the position of lecturer in the Department of English at the University of Adelaide, where he served his entire career. Alan formally retired from the university in 1994, since when he has been an honorary visiting research fellow at the university, as well as pursuing a number of other interests. Alan's research interests at the university have been broad, ranging from Shakespeare to contemporary Australian fiction, but in more recent years with a particular focus on Shakespeare and the performance of his plays in Australia. His particular passion pursued in the academic context more widely has been dance, from dance in Shakespeare to dance in Australia and internationally. And in 1996, Alan was made a member of the Order of Australia for his services to the arts. Alan has an extensive portfolio of publications, including some 15 books and numerous academic and journalistic articles. His reputation extends well beyond the academic community by virtue of his role as a dance critic for a range of journals and newspapers, starting with the newspaper Oniswa at the University of Sydney in 1950 and the Sydney Morning Herald in 1952, and since 1990 for the Australian newspaper. While at the University of Adelaide, Alan served as chair or member of the Education Committee, the Faculty of Arts Committee, and many more. He has presented papers around the world and had visiting fellowships to the Huntington Library, California, and on two occasions to Wolfson College, Oxford. More widely, and I list only a few here, Alan has served on the committees of the ABC, the Adelaide Festival of Arts, the Bibliographical Society of Australia and New Zealand, and the International Shakespeare Association. So, Alan, it's been a long and distinguished career in literature and dance. Can we start by setting the scene and perhaps you describe your early years and what took you to the University of Sydney more than half a century ago?
Yes, Stephen, certainly. I was a country boy, grew up mainly from the age of about seven or eight, around then, in Cowra, in the central west of New South Wales, on the Lachlan River, which is remembered by a great many people as being the scene of the largest POW outbreak in history, which was the Japanese breaking out of the prisoner of war camp over the other side of a hill which is known as Billy Goat Hill, but its official name was Bellevue Hill, I believe, and in August 1944, I believe it was. So that was where I grew up, but I went to a small bush school near the creek, as you mentioned, which is about 8 miles out of Cowra, because my father was appointed there as the teacher. And he was an extremely good teacher, and I owe him an enormous amount, not only for being my father, but for being the model for me when I became a teacher myself. So I went to Cowra High School, I then went on to Sydney University and had a very interesting and delightful student life. I was at St Andrew's College, which was right on campus, and participated. I was a foundation member of the St Andrew's College Dramatic Society, which still flourishes, for example. And as you said, I started writing dance on dance for the student newspaper on Iswa. And lots of things were going on campus, of course. I was mostly in things like university reviews. In fact, my brother Bob, who was in his final honours year of English when I went to the university in 1950, we overlapped by 1 year. But in that year, even though he was doing his honours, he was also co-producing the Sydney University Union Review. So I was in that, and I was in virtually every other review for all the time I was there. And I enjoyed the student life, obviously, but it was terrific to be at Sydney University or at any Australian university in those days, because there was, for a student to have to work to stay at university was very unusual, and we really felt very sorry for anybody who had to do that. And then I did my diploma in education after my honours year at the Teachers College. That was a very recreational year, let us say. And then I was appointed to Cessnock High School for a year and got back to Sydney nearly every weekend if I could. I spent a few weeks in Bathurst before I was seconded to the New South Wales Education Department head office in Sydney. Then I was there for 4 years working at the Teachers College bond that I had because I was on a Teachers College scholarship. When I did finish that, I went off overseas, not knowing exactly what I was going to do. My old professor, Wesley Milgate, may God rest his happy soul, he's a great scholar of Dunn and the Elizabethans. He really fired my interest and imagination in that period. He suggested I write to University College London if I was going over, in case I might do an MA or something. Well, I never heard from them. But anyway, I went over there just to see, you know, as one did.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I'll go and have a look at this place. It didn't bother replying to my letter. And went up the English department. Someone said, can I help you? So, you know, I said, oh, no. But I thought I'd come up and have a look at the place, you know, and explain that I'd written a letter of interest, but didn't get a reply. So he said, what's your name? So I told him, he said, well, where have you been? We've been waiting for you to turn up.
Whoops.
And it appears that the secretary had sent the reply with the requisite papers by C-mail instead of email.
Right.
So anyway, I was in, and then I had enough money to start me off anyway, and I thought, well, I can always teach if I have to. I didn't know then that if I was a full-time student, I was not allowed to have a job. Occasionally, I did, particularly when I got married. My wife, Elizabeth, who I call Libby, we'd been at Sydney University together, but we'd lost touch with each other until she'd been overseas. She came back. We met at a party about 3 months before I was due to leave. Anyway, I wrote and asked if she'd like to come over and get married, and she said yes.
Very good.
And our first child, Roger, was born in London in 1962.
While you were a student?
While I was a student, which sort of necessitated a little bit of extra money because Libby had been working as a secretary. And so I had to keep that under wraps. But that was fine. And as I had all the necessary requirements, an honours degree, diploma in education and the teaching experience, I got a very good screw, in fact. It was really good. It was wonderful. And so I did that for about a month. It kept us for about six.
Right, very good.
Anyway, I came back. I applied for three positions in Australia. And I was interviewed for one of them by Colin Horn, the professor at jury professor in the English department at Adelaide University, at the end of 1962. And he apparently cabled back to Vic Edgelow, the registrar, saying, grab him, which is very nice. He didn't tell me that.
Okay.
But anyway, I got a cable inviting me to turn up as a lecturer in English at the English Department at the University of Adelaide. And on the 23rd of January 1963, so we did that. And thinking, well, we'll go back to Sydney after 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
And we've been here ever since.
Very good.
Yes. Well, so that's how I came to be lecturing English at the University of Adelaide.
Good, good. Well, look, we'll stay at the University of Adelaide, but just in passing, I'll comment that to be interested in dance as a country boy in the 1950s was a bit unusual, but we'll come to dance later on.
Right.
We'll stay at the University of Adelaide.
Right, yes. It is an interesting story, I think. I've been told it's an interesting story.
Okay. So, can you, first of all, can you give a bit of framework for your career at Adelaide, milestones along the way?
Okay. I think that I was very fortunate in being appointed in 1963, which was after the Murray Report. The Napier Building was in process at that stage, and we moved into a brand new building in 1964, the Napier Tower. There were plenty on staff, and it was a very interesting arts faculty at that stage, with people like Hugh Stretton in the history department, and Austin Goff, and various people like that, J.G. Cornell in French, Travascus in classics. The English department had Colin Horn for 18th century, and later on John Colmer, a Coleridge scholar, a variety of other younger lecturers like me, Tim Mayers, who I formed a very close friendship with, and we in fact worked together a great deal on courses in the early English literature period, and it started off with Ralph Elliott and Peter Meredith in medieval studies. Ralph became the foundation professor of English at Flinders University in 1966 when it was founded. Invited a number of us to go and join him, but I decided that the library was too valuable for me at Adelaide. That was one of the things that kept me there, as well as the congeniality of the staff. But a few people went over with him and did well. Tim and I collaborated on co-editing a series of Stuart and Tudor text for the Clarendon Press, for example. What were some of the things we did? I used to run a series of play readings, for example. I've always been, my subject being particularly to drama, I was always very concerned that the students should have drama experience, the experience of the dramatic text as a theatrical text. So in those days we had 3 terms, and each term we would do a rehearsed play reading of a play in the first year, second year, third year syllabuses. Mm-hmm. And these became quite elaborate, really. We costume, but people had their playbooks. And
this was just within the department?
Within the department, for the whole university.
Okay.
The public would come too. We'd put them on in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
We'd rehearse for about a fortnight up in the student common room, and block the moves. And then we in fact had input into the design of what was known as Theatre 5. I'm not quite sure what it is now, 101, the large theatre in the Napier Tower. And so we had, for example, a dais instead of just a flat floor, a removable desk so that we could use it as a stage, tabs at the back and at the side, a lighting rig, and so we really could do quite good stuff. And we gave a flying start to a number of people who became significant in theatre, like Keith Galash, who became eventually the director of the State Theatre Company here. Chris Westwood was involved. Richard Moorcroft, who was the ABC.
ABC, yep.
Yeah. John Edge, who became a noted person in the Theatre Guild. Also, several actresses. Jo Mason, who's on the ABC, who is a programmer for the ABC these days. Lots and lots of people. I feel very pleased at the thought that these people were involved with, you know,
and inspired.
Yeah. And then later on, among my students, I'd like to mention people like Libby Rawpack, who's went on to become the chair of the Helpman Academy and is now, I think, chair of State Opera. Rob Brookman, he was in that group too. Who, of course, had a very stellar career as a theatre director and executive.
This is a roll call of theatre.
Yeah, it is, really.
The luminaries of Adelaide.
Yes, it's wonderful to see this sort of thing and realise that they benefited from the kinds of things we used to do and enjoy doing.
And how long did that continue? The play readings?
Play readings and things like that. Yeah, that's an interesting point, Stephen. I suppose it died out. That would have been in the 70s. It probably died out in the later 80s when money became tighter and staff was reduced. I mean, by the time I was chairman in 1984, we were losing staff. If they retired, they weren't replaced. I mean, that happened, for example, with George Turner, our reader in language. And that happened when I was chairman. I couldn't do anything about it. And by that time, tutorial classes were getting bigger. I mean, when I started, Colin Hoard had a rule that there should only be six people in a tutorial group.
Oh, my word.
Yes. And if you were going to get above six or seven or eight, but preferably six, then you'd hire a part-time tutor. And and that would take up the extras. And that, of course, is no longer the case. By the time I left in 1994, you know, tutorial sizes were really seminar sizes. Like, my room couldn't hold them. I suppose I'd get about 15 or 16. And I don't know what happens these days, whether they can still have proper tutorials or whether they're seminars.
Just going back to this, though, you put two reasons as to why that sort of thing had no longer happens, reduction in staff and money being tighter. Does that mean that if a young academic burning with enthusiasm came along today wanting to start that sort of thing, could it happen, do you think?
It might. But the other thing is that now almost all students have jobs. And, I mean, we had, for example, the Literary Society ran a journal, I think they just produced, in those days, a journal just of poetry. We had a Madrigal group, for example. And there was time to have rehearsals and those sorts of things. And you could schedule something for five till six or something like that after classes had finished.
Mm.
But I doubt that you could do that sort of thing.
It's almost inconceivable now.
Yeah, yes, which is really very sad, because I do think that the modern student is not able to tap into the kind of interrelationship and social relationships which feed the academic relationships.
Mm.
Mm. And just mixing, mixing around. So it's a different atmosphere, a whole different sort of social system in the university now, I'm sure.
So you came to the university in the late 60s, and you climbed the academic ladder, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true, yes. I didn't. I was invited to apply for chairs in other places, but I decided not to. I decided to stay here. And a couple of my colleagues went on to, well, several of my colleagues went on to do that sort of thing. One or two, well, Tom Burton has become a professor, but he's retiring this year. But he was a much younger colleague, of course. Mm. He didn't come till much after me. So I very happily stayed being a reader when I got to that level.
And you published a great deal.
Yes. Well, I suppose I have to agree with you. Compared with the number, I must say, compared with some of my colleagues, I certainly did. But I must say, though, that a number of them are additions. I edited two or three anthologies of essays as a contributing editor. I wrote, my main monograph was on Shakespeare and the Dance, and that was in 1983, I think it was published. 1981, maybe? Goodness, I should know. In Shakespeare, apart from that, my main publication is the Oxford Shakespeare edition of As You Like It, which was published in 1993, and that continues to be in print. There's been a few editions of Australian things along the way, particularly Rolf Boldrewood. I made a particular study of Rolf Boldrewood and wrote a small booklet on him for the Australian Oxford authors and their works. That was about 1972, I think I did that.
Going back to those times, was the pressure to publish?
I don't think in Adelaide we have ever had that publish or perish syndrome that Americans had. I can remember when I was writing my thesis in London, Samuel Schoenbaum, who's a very noted Shakespearean scholar, alas now dead, he was a wonderful man, he said, which publisher are you going to take your thesis to, Alan? That's a price. I never thought of that, and in fact I never did publish it as a thesis, but I did use it for articles, and when I did an edition of Thomas Middleton's play Chase Made in Cheapside, I drew heavily on my thesis for that. So it wasn't wasted.
And you developed this specialism for dance in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And forgive me, I don't remember much dance in Shakespeare.
Oh.
Is it there? Or
Yes, it occurs in at least 34 of his plays. There are mentions, I can't remember, I haven't got the figures in my head right now, but dance is an important symbol of harmony, and in those days I felt that Shakespeare's plays always worked towards harmonious conclusions of some kind.
Right.
Not all of them do, of course, the tragedies don't. And this is why, for example, in Macbeth, you've got the witches doing a dance in the wrong direction.
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah.
And contrary to all the films and all the productions, Romeo and Juliet do not dance.
Right.
He sees her and she sees him. Oh, she does teach the torches to burn bright, he says, you know. They meet and their hands touch.
Right.
But in fact, they are called apart. So that's a tragedy.
Right.
Whereas, Much Ado About Nothing, you finish up with the dance, strike up pipers and the dance, and As You Like It finishes with the dance. Yes, there's lots of dance in Shakespeare.
And did he actually specify the nature of the dance?
Sometimes a measure will measure a measure upon the grass is one of the lines, for example, in Love's Labour's Lost. And the measure was a stately dance, a pavane.
Okay.
There are... I could go on.
Well, with, you know. clearly, I
don't read the book. Don't read the book, dear.
But back to the university. You were appointed as lecturer. You became
senior
lecturer, and then reader, now branded associate professor.
Yes.
You would have been given the chance to be called an associate professor.
Oh yes, that was interesting. The university, when they decided to introduce that as a term, had a ballot to see what readers wanted, whether they wanted to become associate professors or not. It was split absolutely 50-50 down the middle. So in the English department, Tom Burton had just been made a reader and was very proud of it. And he and I decided we'd stay as readers. But there may have been others who decided to become associate professors.
Mm.
And it was useful if you went to America because they could call you professor.
Was thinking there would have been a humanities science divide there to some degree.
There could well have been, I suppose. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, someone said, "Well, I don't want to be an aspro."
Mm. You see. Yes. But as you climb the tree, inevitably you get drawn into the management aspects of departments and faculties. You played your part in that?
Oh, I think I probably did. As you said, I was on the Education Committee as a member and the Arts Faculty Board, and I suppose I was on appointment boards and all those sorts of things, and eventually became, I can't remember the year, but we began having elected heads of department, and Tim Mayers was the first one. Because there was some little bit of friction in the department, as you might say, in those days, and we decided we'd like to have an elected head, and the University Council approved the move, and Tim became the first head. I succeeded, I think, Kenneth Ruthven, who'd been appointed as a professor to the department, 1981, and I think I succeeded him. I always remember him saying to me, "You'll find, Alan, that your days become a mosaic."
Right.
Little bits of this, little bits of this. And it was certainly true. I think I was only there for 2 years, 84 and 85. And I had a few problems with some past graduates. Not with the staff. It was a pretty happy department under my chairmanship, I believe, and have been told so. But I was glad to leave it to the others because I was trying to finish off a book and had an article or two that I wanted to write, and all that just had to be put on hold. So I was glad enough to get rid of it. But I must say, one of the lifesavers of the university in those days, and I don't know whether it still applies, was the very good study leave provisions.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first went, we had to take a year. And so my first study leave year was 1968. And we went to London, and
then after that we were allowed to take shorter periods, and I think that was very, very good.
Mm.
And I generally took 8 months or less after that. And the provisions were very generous because we were on full pay. We got a living allowance for family, and we got fares.
My word.
So I don't know whether that applies now. I suppose I should have phoned up to find out before I came to this interview. No. But it'd be easy enough to find out if that's true. But that was wonderful. And in 1974, we went to Oxford for the first time because I realised the Bodleian Library, great library, and it was close to Stratford,
mm-hmm.
where I could do Shakespearean research.
Indeed.
And so every other study leave except one, which was when I had my fellowship at the Huntington Library in 1979, our study leave was spent in Oxford. And that was true. It was very good for my three children, particularly my daughter, who was able to go to a very good school both times she came with us. And so the study leave provisions of Adelaide University I'm very grateful for. And as well as that, one could apply for grants. I've had a number of... I was fortunate in getting a number of grants over the years I was at the university to help me in research. And all those sorts of things.
But just touching back on your role in management at the university, it seems to me it's one of the essential problems for a university that academics need to manage, but also there are professional managers in the university, and there are calls increasingly for accountability from government, which need to be professionally managed, and a large administration is called for all this sort of thing. And
getting very, very top heavy.
It's in the nature of the beast almost, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's extraordinary the way the administrative load increased in the last 10 years, I suppose, that I was at the university. I remember when Penny Bimler was appointed professor. It was on the strength of her research record, and I saw her maybe 4 or 5 years later, and she just said at one stage, she said, well, she said, you know, I came here because of my research and as well as my administrative abilities, and they still want me to do research, but if I'm going to, the way it's going, I just don't have time to do any, you know. And by the time I left, it was like that with us too. I think the computer is partly to blame, Stephen, because, you know, we used to have 2 or 3 secretaries in the department. The professor had his secretary and the one other full-time and one part-time now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we would give them work to do. You'd send off a letter that you'd written, or you'd dictate a letter, and it would come back and sign it off and go. But then in come computers. Everybody gets a computer. So you do your own letters. Well, that takes more time. And so it goes. And then people send emails. And now I noticed you can sign up for a course, how to manage your email.
Right.
Need I say more?
But this is... the world has changed in this,
oh, absolutely.
In this way.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, irresistible. And the world of the universities has changed because of the weight of government intrusion and government control and government calls for accountability, surely. The beast has changed, hasn't it?
Oh, it has. It has, yes. Yeah, undoubtedly. So I feel myself very lucky to have been there when it was not like that.
Right. And so the modern academic probably needs a different attitude and different skills.
Well, I think that's true, particularly when there's online learning and that kind of thing. I mean, I think some of that's very exciting stuff.
I still believe that the very best teaching can take place in a face-to-face situation, ideally between a student and a tutor. I think that that's the ideal situation. But small group teaching, of course, is terrifically valuable and very, very good. And I was very interested to see in the new Vice-Chancellor Warren Bevington's strategic plan, which has just been issued, there's a whole section in which he said one of the aims is to return to small group teaching.
Indeed, in his inaugural lecture, he was citing the Humboldt model from Berlin.
Well, I wish him good luck.
It will be interesting. Are there particular identities within the university who you care to recall and reflect on?
Oh my goodness.
We can elide over that if you like. But,
no, I must say that of all the vice chancellors that was at the university that when I was there, I think Geoffrey Badger was the finest. He had a certain humaneness about him, and he was very, I thought, excellent with students. I mean, at one stage, there was a student occupation going on in the Vice-Chancellor's office, and he cooled the whole thing down magnificently. on a personal level, when I was producing Richard II in 1969 for the Theatre Guild, I'd heard about some costumes that the Elizabethan Theatre Trust had in their production of a Henry IV play, I think. And for some reason, I was in his office and that came up. And he said, well, do you want them? And I said, well, yeah, I'd really like to, but I don't know Jeff, because I did call him Jeff. He said, well, there's the phone, ring them up.
Right.
I don't know whether that happened these days. It might. But he was that sort of person, and on a personal level, he was very good. Not that there weren't other great. Noel Flinchy and Don Stranks, for example, were wonderful people. And I think that those sorts of things. And of course,
Well, it was under Geoffrey Badger that enormous growth was taking place, wasn't it? The Whitlam years and so on. And the university probably, this is a question, probably had to become a little less personal once it became so much larger.
Well, I think that that's inevitably true. And I guess that may have been when the sorts of things that I was talking about earlier had to slow down. For example, I can remember sometime before 1970, I organised a concert. The Elder Hall had free lunchtime concerts every Thursday, and I organised one entirely performed by members of the English department staff and students, except for one. There was a piano duet with Rosemary Sweetapple, who became Rosemary Moore, who was a lecturer. She played a piano duet, the Italian Concerto Bach, with Philip Britton, who was on the conservatorium staff. But maybe that could happen today, I don't know, maybe it could. But it certainly happened then.
One would like to think so.
Well,
maybe we can move to your sort of wider persona, because you certainly had a very rich life outside the walls of the university. Or maybe some of these areas within the university that were not strictly curricular, but associated with it. You had the early imprints project, and the students had the literary society. Would you
I think perhaps I could mention. What about if I talked about a dance and drama in the department, in the university? Have I got time to do that?
Please do.
All right. Well, there was a feeling. I suppose it was particularly Tim and I in the English department, but there were other people around the university who thought that there was a place for a drama discipline in the department, in the university. So we set up a committee for the performing arts, which I chaired. And we did, in fact, appoint a drama lecturer, and there was a drama department. Jim Villay was the first fellow, senior lecturer in drama. I interviewed him in 1974, and he was a member of that department. He was the head of it until 1986, and it produced a number of people. Well, I think it was around, perhaps it was 1986 when the, no, it was 1991 when the South Australian College of Advanced Education merged with the university, and the drama department from that organisation came over with Frank Ford in charge. Well, they produced a number of people. I mean, Chris Drummond, who is the director of Brink Productions, for example,
yep.
And Michael Hill, Andy Packer, who's got a children's company, which is internationally famous, people like that. Then in 1996, under Vice-Chancellor Mary O'Kane, it was dissolved. So that was the end of drama as in the University of Adelaide. Now, in 1981, I was also instrumental in setting up the dance department in the University of Adelaide, and that was the first Bachelor of Arts, Performing Arts dance in an Australian university.
Right.
There were dance departments in other tertiary institutions like Kelvin Grove, for example, in Melbourne, which eventually became part of Monash University, and others.
So dance was most closely associated with the English department, was it?
Not really. The conservatory? No. It was independent.
Okay.
But it did have, later on, a Faculty of Performing Arts was in fact formed.
Yep.
And there was a collaboration between them. I noticed the other day that Steve Whittington, for example, one of the conservatory staff, composed the music for one of David Roche's ballets.
Right.
One of his dance pieces. But the dance department was really very successful. I think that virtually every graduate found a place somewhere. And they're still around, like Adi Suharto, an Australian-Indonesian girl who's really going great guns. She goes over to Indonesia and she comes back here. She had something in Oz Asia recently. That's just one example.
Yeah.
So even though it was closed down in 1996 also, it did produce good work.
And the cause for the closures?
Cost cutting, I suppose.
Right.
Performing arts are labour intensive, and you don't get such a big bang for your buck, but you get a more valuable bang for your buck. Because it is more intensive than you do in larger departments. And it's lots of individual teaching. And I understand that the Vice-Chancellor at the time, who got rid of these two, had her eyes on the conservatorium next, and there were a number of protests about that and other things. Well,
Perhaps you could talk to other people about that particular vice chancellor.
Yes, I think the conservatorium is held very dear in all of Adelaide's heart, isn't it?
It is indeed. Yes. So, but then other things concerned with the arts at the university. I was one of the more enjoyable committees that I was on was the Works of Art Committee, which which was first had the idea of that. Buddy Rogers, microbiology, I think, professor, and some of his other scientific confreres, had the idea about 1961 or two. I think it came into being in 1965, and I found it very enjoyable to be on because I was with a number of people from different disciplines. Mm. I mean, Tom Browning, the entomology professor at the Waite, David Saunders from architecture, at one stage Rosemary Brooks, the principal of St Anne's College, isn't it? The Women's College, was on it. And we had Kimber Knighton as an advisor. We gained funds from various places, some donations. I mean, Max Harris presented the Barsmith Library through us with a set of Arthur Boyd paintings and his poems to go with them.
Yep.
You know about that.
Angry Penguins.
Yes, yep. Angry Penguin stuff. Mm. And then we also have a very fine set of Arthur Boyd oils, the Judge series, which we bought for the university through and the union. Collaborated with that. The Henry Moore sculpture, which is there, that's through the Artworks of Art Fund. Mm. And eventually, the university employed a curator. Now, I must point out that the Works of Art Fund put out the university said they couldn't afford it, so an invitation was sent out to staff to contribute part of their salary. And it was really wonderful that this was done, and we got a great deal of money from that. But gradually, it faded away, understandably.
Mm.
But that was how it really got going.
Mm.
Now the university has a curator, and I have here somewhere a wonderful book.
Haruch. Yep.
Yep, a terrific book on the University of Adelaide art collections.
Well, the Works of Art Committee would still have existed when the South Australian College merged with the university.
That's right.
Because they brought a lot.
They brought a lot with them.
They had the War Memorial collection.
That's right. Yep. The Hartley collection.
Hartley collection.
That's right. And this was a book published by Paula Furby, or written by Paula Furby and Betty Snowden. And John Perkins, I think, was the first university art curator. And that was published when the no date. Never mind. Anyway, it's certainly there, and it's a good, beautiful.
Well, the university did, as you say, have the funds to buy works of art in those days, and also attract them.
Mm.
I don't think those things happen now, do they?
Well, maybe not. I really don't know. Of course, the other big donation that did a great deal for the university was, I don't know how much it was, which funded the foundation of 5UV, Radio Adelaide.
Right.
And that was in the late 60s, perhaps. I can't remember. But and it started off underneath what was it called? The Hughes Plaza.
The Plaza, yes.
It was under the plaza.
Next to the new part of the Barsmith Library.
That's right.
Yes.
And Keith Conlon.
Indeed.
Was one of the first people involved.
Yes.
And I remember.
So that was built on the basis of donated funds?
A magnificent donation from a man who was an engineer, I think.
Right.
I don't know the details of that.
Right.
But it's grown into the premier community radio station in Australia. It's got more awards than any other community radio station in Australia. And it's been a breeding ground for lots and lots and lots of radio and television people.
Mm.
And, you know, still is. And I think I gave a series of talks on poetry or something in those early days. And so I've been connected with that for a long time because I still do reviews, interviews.
It was very much a university radio station to start with, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
But now it's become much more broadly based in the community.
Well, that's true, but it is still the university station.
But drawing much more widely.
Oh, indeed. Yes, indeed. It's not just a voice for the university.
And the Theatre Guild, you were active with the Theatre Guild.
Well, only to a certain extent. I was never on the committee of that, but I did produce a play for them, which was Richard II.
Right.
And
is there any dancing in Richard II?
No dancing.
No dancing.
No, that's one of the lines.
Horses, but no dancing.
No. That's Richard III. when Richard's in dire straits and his poor wife is concerned about it all, one of her ladies says, trying to cheer up, "Shall we have music, my lady? Shall we dance?" He said, no dancing, girl.
Right.
It's a tragedy.
But moving on to dance, then you became a dance critic.
Early on.
Very early on, as an undergraduate student, and here we are, what, 60 years later, and you're still doing it.
Yes, that's right. Well, very briefly, before we went to Cowra, a couple of schools before, we were at a school in the Riverina in New South Wales, and my parents got a journal called the Sydney Mail, and in 1938 the Ballet Russe came to Australia. And the Sydney Mail ran a series of articles with rather fuzzy photographs. They were the first action photographs of Australia, dance that had been taken in Australia, I imagine. And for some reason, I was captivated by it. I was always skipping around. My parents were both musical. They put on school concerts, and I always wanted to get involved in those. I never learned dancing. Well, I had 6 tap dancing lessons once in Cowra. but my brother encouraged it. He sent me a book, Arnold Haskell's book on ballet, just called Ballet, the Penguin book, when he went to university. And so I was always interested in it. And when I got to the university in Sydney, I started writing. And fortunately, Borovansky's ballet had started again in 1950. And it was a very exciting time to be around.
Yeah.
And so out of that came the book that was published finally last year, 2010 actually, called Australia Dances, which I wrote back in the 1950s and 60s with a friend, Keith Glennon, who died, but was published when he died. All the papers were brought over to the Masterpiece Library, and it was finally, I got them into shape and was finally published by Wakefield Press.
Yeah.
But yes, I just have kept it as an interest. There it is.
And added greatly to the cultural life of the country, indeed. not just South Australia. So.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, as I said in the introduction, it has been a long and distinguished career, Alan. Would you? Before we wrap this up, do you have any other reflections you'd like to make?
Oh, my goodness me. Well, Adelaide was a great place to bring up children. My wife, Elizabeth, also was able to finish her BA in Adelaide, that she had to stop in Sydney when her father moved to Perth.
Mm-hmm.
She finished that, and then later on she went on and did a theology degree. So she's got 2 degrees. And then we had our 3 children, who've all done, I have to say, very well.
All graduates from the University of Adelaide?
No, 2. But the second one, Piers, was not academic.
Okay.
But he got a job in the microbiology department as a tech laboratory technician, went on to become, eventually after 20 years, the resources manager with the Department of Environmental Biology, and now works in the Environment Department of the state government.
Right.
As the manager of a biodiversity unit, I think it is.
But nevertheless, the University of Adelaide is definitely in the Brissenden blood.
Oh, it is, yes. Well, Roger was an astrophysicist. He graduated from here, and he's now with the Smithsonian Harvard Astrophysical Observatory in Boston. Celia did English honours. She won't sit to me. I won't let you down that. In fact, she has not. And she is now with the Primary Industries Research of South Australia.
Right.
She's in that department as a media officer after a very interesting career in the arts. So, yes, and I've had a wonderful time being involved with the Adelaide Festival and the Arts Council of South Australia and writing about all these things and talking to you this afternoon.
Well, it's been very enjoyable, Alan. Thank you very much for this. My name is Stephen Beaumont, let me just again thank you, Alan, and wish you well for the future.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's been a great pleasure.
Stop that. 59 minutes. 59? 56.
Oh, well, whoops. Just on the air.
Okay.
Oh, well, I think we covered enough ground.
How was that?
Oh, fine. You just let me rattle on. And well, prompted me occasionally, which was good.
Which was my intention, but did we cover enough ground, do you think?
Oh, I think so, yes. We kept off the bickerings in the English department. I didn't think there was any point in talking about that.
A good thing to do, yes. This is meant to have...